It's Monday the 16th of December and I'm with Joyce Kalavik, the National Director of WISH, the only user-led national charity for women's mental health, working in prisons, hospitals and the community. Joyce is sharing her experience of working in the women's voluntary and community sector and campaigning for women's rights for the Sisters Doing It for Themselves archive. Joyce, if you can begin by sharing with us what were the influences that brought you to work in the voluntary sector?
Well, I'm from a strong working class Liverpool community, and I've always had a passion to promote a more equal society and a campaign against injustice. So I started working in the voluntary sector in 1989. And really, I just went with the flow of, I had a small research and consultancy agency called ERAS then, Evaluation Research Advisory Service, and it was about the time of Care in the Community where monitoring and evaluation was the buzzword. I'd done business and marketing and my master's was in social research methods. I had two small children and I'd moved from Oxford to Bristol. I wanted to work, I would have been a terrible mother if I hadn't have worked. And so I set up a business from my home, which was had an extra floor for an office. And I just went with the flow of what was the key theme. And I started with HIV and AIDS and working, evaluating different projects, and then I suppose my main theme has always been around disability. Mm-hmm. So working with learning disability organisations, I've worked as a consultant with People First self-advocacy for 20 years. I've worked with in mental health, in physical impairment, hearing impairment. So basically, and disability is my background because I parented both my parents. My mum had learning difficulties and my dad was quite strong, but he had his first stroke when I was like 8. Mm. So, I think that's what's given me my confidence and independence and ability to do things, really, because I had to. That was my background. So I had an affinity with disability, and I know that the discrimination was very widespread, and that actually that's the myth, really, of disabled people. Disabled people are just like everybody else. They've got the same potential, and given the opportunity, they can reach that potential.
And what influenced you to move into the women's sector?
Well, I as part of my consultancy, it was about crisis management for organisations, fundraising, and so I was brought into WISH. And often I'd stay and be acting director and then move on to another organisation and do the same. And so I came in contact with WISH in 2002, when the organisation was in a terrible state, like a lot of, voluntary sector organisations. But actually, I think... So I did, I did fundraising and I wasn't part of the structure, I was external. And then the trustees asked me to stay as acting director, and of course I felt I was coming home. And that's where I've stayed, really. So it was the first paid job I'd ever had as part of an organisation. I'd always been a researcher or a consultant, and that was that was lovely to feel part of something as somebody with a lived experience of mental health. Mm-hmm. And very similar to many of the women we work with, to be part of that movement to try and improve services and the life chances of women, and to give them power and give them a voice. That's always been the part of the job that I'm passionate about, really, is working with the women, because it's so inspirational. An organisation like WISH, a user-led organisation, women know that we know, where they're coming from and what support they need, and how they need to be, empowerment needs to be part of the process. It's not doing something for someone, it's supporting somebody to do something for themselves. And yeah, so I actually don't work with the women now, and I haven't for quite a lot. Well, for 5 years I was assaulted on a psychiatric ward by somebody who tried to break my neck, and I was really unwell for a while, and I and the organisation suffered as a result of that. But obviously I see women in the Community Link project, but I used to be an advocate. I used to do some advocacy work in a secure unit, and that is so incredible to see how women, they just, you go on the ward and you're their one light of hope. Mm-hmm. We do a gender specific advocacy service, which is proactive. So we're not just waiting for a phone call that never comes from women, because they, they just deal with shit. They don't know they've got a, they don't know it's a problem. They don't know it can be resolved. So that was, that was very inspiring. And I think that just working with the women gives you the inspiration and passion to carry on.
Even when you get your neck broken.
Even when I get my neck broken.
And one of the first, I suppose, practical examples of helping women was the Women's First Refuge set up by Irene Pissy. Did that influence your decision making at all?
No, I think it was more, I suppose I was a teenager in the 60s in Liverpool, where everything and anything was possible. Feminism, working class barriers being broken down, working class kids going to further education with grants. So I became very political. And also, I personally wasn't like the other women of that era. I mean, I'm 68. So, gender was only really, that was in 60, 68, 69. So gender was not, full on the scene sort of thing, but politics was. Mm-hmm. So I think that, my actions have been more politically motivated. And I know that, I know I'm a very strong woman. I'm confident in my decision making. I'm very analytical. And that's all through my own childhood experience. Mm-hmm. That's made me, given me those qualities, if you like. So it was weird, really, because I suppose I did, and I also took male educational options, if you like, business, marketing. But I know that, and that's who I was, and I know that the other women in the circle didn't really relate to me very much, because they were partners of other people. And I was quite ostracised, really, because they didn't, you know, I was, you know, who do you think she is, sort of thing. I mean, I'm very close friends with them, but it was a process, really. So I really became more politically active around, it was more in the, you know, around Greenham Common, and, you know, being with women there, being more aware of women. And then, you know, onwards through Thatcher and the miners' strike. And so I suppose really it was just it was a greater political awareness, really. And it really wasn't till I came, and it was around impairment and around disability. So it wasn't really until I came to Wish that I, you know, it was, that was my own personal sort of awakening. Because I think that I had been in denial about my own history as a child and young woman, and, you know, completely blocked that out. So it's hard then to engage with a movement that is, you know, sort of profiling that, if you like.
Can you expand a little bit more on your awakening?
When I came to Wish?
Mm.
Well, I suppose I felt incredibly at home with all the women, and they felt very at home with me. And I wish, although it had been, you know, sort of, it hadn't been a user-led organisation then, although there had been elements, but I made the structural constitutional changes for it to becoming a user-led organisation. And I think the one thing that always struck me was that, actually, you know, the world's full of policy claptrap. We did some groundbreaking research before I started, which resulted in Into the Mainstream. we're in Strategy for Mental Health. Actually, there were no resources behind it at all. And this had always been my sense when I was a researcher, that, you know, people get all the glory, do the really satisfying work of the research, the discussions, the debate, and then it just goes on a shelf. Mm-hmm. So I suppose my passion or my awakening was to realise that the women we worked with deserved better. Just better from services, basically, because that's the thing, you know, no matter how much we as Wish do, or small charities, it's services that make or break them. And actually, for the women we work with, it breaks them, because, you know, everything we do is then completely undermined by what happens in statutory services. And, you know, it was just a farce, this Into the Mainstream. There was a conference, and everybody was supposed to, all the mental health trusts were supposed to have a women's lead. And we went to this conference, and, like, virtually everybody had been asked to be women's lead for the day. You know, it wasn't, like, taken seriously at all. And nothing really much happened. And then, so what we wanted to do was to put that policy into practice. And we developed, we got some funding from Comic Relief to do this, it was called Policy into Practice, Keeping on Track. And it was to work with secure units so that women could review the unit policies and see how, you know, where they fell down in relation to gender. But with a name like that, we couldn't get into the hospitals. They saw it as really threatening, giving women power, which is something I totally take for granted. You know, and I think that's one of the, and so we had to change it to voices, actions, services together or something to get in. So I suppose the awakening was that I had had very similar background to the women we work with. I could have very easily been one of these women in hospital or in prison. That I had two things. I mean, I never really tell my story, and I'm not really going into great detail now, but when my dad became ill, I then was sort of lent to somebody, and it was a very abusive relationship. I was there for 8 years. But, you know, I got through it. And it was, I knew there was no malice on the part of my parent. I knew it was just what had happened sort of thing. But the two things that saved me, if you like, was I had a GP, and I don't know, in those days the surgery was in a terraced house. You went in and there'd be 20 people sitting there, and then the last one in and say, "You're after me." So this is when I was about 13, and he would sit and listen to me for an hour and a half, and, you know, talk to me about what he knew, my family, he called in to see them. I was on antidepressants, and he listened, and there was a teacher at school who similarly, you know, was aware of my circumstances and, you know, was not intrusively supportive, but, you know, and he was there for me sort of thing. So I suppose, you know, the thing that I knew was that if there's somebody there for you, it makes a big difference. And I suppose I had, you know, I was quite academic, so I had an education, and therefore I could work, I could be financially independent. So, you know, what we want at Wish is to, it's gone through, you know, we do intensive support for women in crisis, that's not enough. So we're developing a project, because then it only keeps women in crisis, it doesn't really move them on. And some women do, but a lot of women have incredibly difficult time letting go, and it's those women who've experienced injustice, if you like, at the hands of the state, the courts, the prison, police, you know, who can't let it go, because not only had they the, you know, injustice of their own experience, but also the injustice of services that didn't believe them or, you know, kick them again sort of thing. So, you know, we've just developed a gender-specific counselling module, and we're piloting it with some funding from Hope and Grace, an American charitable giving organisation. And then we're going to try and get, we have done some sort of training education work, but we want to get something sort of going at the other end, that maybe it's a cooperative, a women's cooperative, so women can build, because they could never go into employment, you know, even, you know, the real world sort of thing. A lot of women, you know, a lot of the women who haven't been able to move, you know, move forward. So we want something that will, you know, be an end-to-end sort of package, if you like. So what inspired me is that I know how strong, these women are strong to be alive. You know, I know how strong women are. But that shouldn't just be enough. We should be, you know, supporting them to build that strength, to, you know, sort of have, you know, to become real citizens, to feel hopeful about life, to enjoy things rather than, you know, going through day after day, you know, absolute hell, reliving what's happened to them, or, you know, being denigrated by services and the state. So I think that, and yeah, I mean, women need, and that is actually also women just need to step into their power. They need to be not afraid to say what they want, say what they think. You know, they are so used to accommodating, ducking and diving, not offending anybody, not wanting to, you know, sort of tip the cart, you know, and so they're always in the shadow. I've got this great article from Good Housekeeping in the 50s about the role of women, you know, what you must do when your husband comes home, and that's where it's all come from, really. And, you know, that's what's been fed. And I think, I'm not saying it's different for white middle-class women, but they have had some, you know, of my era anyway, they will have had some advantage that has enabled them to have an education or, you know, to feel less blighted by their gender or whatever. But, you know, working-class women, bloody hell, they're absolutely, you know, immensely powerful, but they've just got to, you know, be encouraged and have the confidence to step into that and to speak their truth, really, to tell their story. I've never told my story, even to the people, you know, even to people here. I mean, if I've only just really, you know, I blocked out those 8 years and I've never been able to think about them. And it was actually the assault which, you know, obviously any trauma makes you revisit previous traumas. So it's only then. So when I identified with Wish and the women, I didn't know why. I sort of did. I knew why it was. I could just say yes, you know. But I didn't really fully understand why that was. I think that, you know, that's our mission, really, to help people, help women step into their power and speak their truth.
You've kind of touched on this a little bit. Who inspired you and who inspires you now? And how do they do it? And
I don't know. I'm very independent. I'm very not influenced. What inspires me is that what inspires me is the strength of women. I think, I don't know what inspires me. Liverpool inspires me. You know, Liverpool is the place where people aren't trodden down. You know, they don't feel, it's a class, I think everything's a class thing, actually, across any of the, you know, equalities. But I suppose the person who most inspired me, is my shamanic mentor. I went to a women's shamanism school and did a shamanic course in shamanism. And I'm being with those women and that woman who, you know, we saw ourselves as illumined warriors. No, I haven't. You know, all the fantastic women. Music inspires me, and poetry, but from my era, it was mainly male poets, and or male singers, songwriters. You know, sort of. Yeah, around. And the thing is, all my friends are men. All my very best friends are men. So it's weird, isn't it, that I don't really identify with... I don't identify with being a woman. Well, do you know what I mean? I don't identify with being a working... I don't identify with being... I think it goes... for me, it's all about class, basically.
How would you describe your approach to leadership?
Ooh.
Could you describe your leadership style?
Well, it's from the centre. It's very Taoist. It's about not being conspicuous. It's about leading. It's about allowing other people to lead and grow. It's about being clear about, you know, I'm a strategic planner, so it's about being clear about, you know, what the aims and objectives are and having proper plans in place to do that. And about supporting other, because I haven't had this, because as a consultant, I was always outside organisations. I was a facilitator. I'm more of a facilitator, I think. And I don't, you know, I don't have a big presence, really. I don't try to have a big presence. It's more, for me, within Wish, it's more about whether Wish has a profile rather than me personally. And I think that's, a dilemma that people who've got a potential leadership role can get into. Then they become, you know, Wish is the electricity, we're all light bulbs. I might be a bit stronger light bulb, if you like. But a lot of people, and, you know, in organisations, they think they're the electricity and they detract from the organisation. So I think it's always very, you know, I always say, you know, whatever decision you make, it's got to be what, it's not about, you know, what you do personally, it's about how it'll impact on Wish. So I'm probably more of a facilitator than a leader.
And can you give an example of how you have in practice worked with a staff group and put Wish first as opposed to any one individual?
I suppose Wish had campaigning roots, you know, with our research, but and then we deliver services, we work with women in the community and advocacy, and I wanted to get Wish back into a campaigning mode, really, because regardless of, you know, the research, the policy, if nothing changes, it's all just treading water, really. So I think that one of the things that I've done, that we've done, is that we had our, we set up our Women's Mental Health Network, and we launched it with Turn Up, and there was quite a lot of, you know, but what about the women? You want to take our support away from the women, you know, you're prioritising something else over what we give. But actually, you know, what we're trying to do is to ensure that we don't have to give so much, and organisations and like us, so that, you know, that services can change. So we consulted women about what things they wanted. We'd had focus groups, and we consulted women about what things they'd like to change, and so they chose 10 areas, and in the focus group there were 10 areas, and we've chosen two. One is to develop gender-specific counselling from a trauma-informed perspective, and the other is to look at the role of male staff in prisons and what is and isn't appropriate for them to do. And we've now started that process of the pilots and working with the MOJ. And, you know, it's about, you know, and now staff can see the value in that. You know, the more you change, the less need there is, or that, you know, for women to be dependent on support services that aren't there, I suppose. And that's my passion, really, is campaigning and change. And I suppose the thing is, I don't identify with any gender. I'm very modern. I'm very Maggie Nelson. No, honestly, I don't. That is weird, isn't it? I don't think about gender as a differentiator, because look at working class men as well. You know, do you know what I mean? Yeah. Look of lack of privilege generally.
I'm thinking about leadership. Do you think there's a difference between women's leadership to men's leadership?
Yeah. Although, look at Boris and Jeremy. I would imagine men are less consultative, they're more confident, they more lead from the front, they're more visible, they're more, I suppose they've made up their mind before, you know, before taking action, and, you know, they drive that forward. I think women, know what they want, but often don't feel comfortable in, you know, driving that forward, really, because they're less, it's almost like, you know, my issue would be you shouldn't have to become like a man to be a leader and to be successful. You should be able to do it in your own right as a woman. But it's about getting that balance, isn't it, really? That yin-yang balance. Because sometimes you do have to be, you know, you just have to say, no, you can't do that. I've had to say that today. You cannot do that. It's in breach of our agreement. It might seem like a good idea, but you can't do it. So I think also, well, people take their personal attributes, don't they, as well, into any, you know, sort of leadership or organisational role. And, you know, women have been carers and supporters. And so, you know, there can be a very, you know, there can be a, an unwillingness to engage in anything that doesn't have that element to it. And I think that, you know, can prevent women from, you know, taking the command they need to really ensure that what needs to be done is done. And it's quite a fine line, really, isn't it? I mean, obviously, nobody wants to compromise their own, you know, personal beliefs or behaviours. But I think sometimes, you know, you do, you have to separate who you are as a person, you know, from who you are in your organisational capacity, mm-hmm. and feel okay about it.
What do you think are the specific characteristics of being a leader in the women's sector?
Well, I think feeling part of the sector, you know, having a good, you know, being part of a network and knowing what's happening. But I think also, it's also a very dog eat dog world. You know, sometimes you think that, you know, we've shared things with people, who've then gone off and taken them, sort of thing. So say, what was the question again?
It was the specific characteristics of being a leader in the women's sector.
You've got to believe in yourself, and you've got to believe in your cause, really. You've got to... Well, I mean, my background is in user-led organisations per se. So I think you've got to have an insight into the work that you're doing, and obviously having experience of that as well. I mean, is, you know, sort of incredibly important. You've got, I think... Well, planning is the key to success, that's, you know, and so knowing what your goals are and knowing how you're going to get there is really important. and not alienating yourself from your organisation as a women's organisation, because I think it's a very, you know, it's treading the line really between, you know, forcing things through and taking people with you, and I think that's quite a fine balance. And I think it's really hard, because you don't want to be autocratic as a leader, but there's got to be a common understanding, and I think that is a really tricky issue to address. Yeah, I think
you've spoken about the issues that are dear to your heart. How do you think you have influenced change?
Well, it's hard, isn't it? Change is hard. My consultancy changed from ERAS to Change Plus. So I think it's possibly easier to influence change from outside an organisation as a consultant to support an organisation to do that, for me anyway, to do that. I think change is incredibly difficult. But the whole societal move around awareness of, the move from, you know, mental health, gender specific, domestic violence and abuse, the whole joining together of those dots and it becoming one big movement. And I think as an organisation, you know, you're part of that movement. But as a single organisation, you've got to have your own goals. And I suppose, Mark, the thing that's important for me and for Wish is to put that policy into practice. And I think I think that it's, you know, you could, I don't know, wallpaper the walls of Buckingham Palace with all the research and policy, but actually how things change, you know, what has changed in women's mental health? I think, you know, there's more awareness of, you know, the role of violence and abuse. But actually, it's no use just saying services need to be trauma-informed. Because it's institutional change, and it's resistant, and people are being asked to change all the time. So you've really got to, demonstrate that it's possible, that it's not, that change has got to happen bit by bit, and that's why we're taking this approach to the gender-specific counselling, to the changing, looking at the role of men in male staff in female prisons. It's about It's being there for the long haul, basically. It's not, you know. And I just think it's so much easier to slip back into research and policy for people, and that's where the funding is. It's hard, you know. It's hard. We are still an unpopular cause, even though, you know, all the rhetoric around gender, violence, abuse, you know, the power balance. You know, we're still with funders, an unpopular cause. But there's a lot of funding out there for policy and research. There's not a lot of funding for change.
How has your involvement in the women's sector impacted on you personally?
One of the things that's always been apparent in relation to WISH is that we straddle several sectors. We're mental health organisations, that's about disability. We're an advocacy organisation, and we're a women's organisation as well. So I think that, and you know, so to a certain extent, I was treasurer of NSUN, National Survivor User Network, the National Women's Mental Health Organisation. I think to a certain extent, that is impacted on by the fact that we do identify with mental health. And therefore are not, so, you know, got a foot in two camps, if you like. But I think, you know, that whole, you know, the sense of community, the telling stories, that feeling of, you know, having support from, you know, with, from being involved with other organisations and partnerships is really important. I also think we're a bit, WISH is a bit also on the outskirts of things, because we're a user-led, or we do, you know, we're user-led, and the process is as important as the outcome. And that makes us different from organisations who can just wham bam, you know, sort of get things done. And it's, well, it's hard, isn't it? It's very hard in the women's sector. I think it's still hard. You know, how people come together. It's, you know, fighting the patriarchy, you know, sort of, you know, how you, you know, not feeling compromised by it. And I think the women's sector has so many different elements as well, doesn't it, really? And I'm not, I think, you know, it would be great to have sense of more cohesive framework. I think that the grassroots women's organisations, just like the grassroots self-advocacy organisations, are so important to women to have somewhere to go, you know, to have. I think that the local services and support that women get from local organisations is, you know, makes the difference between, you know, survival and not for a lot of women. You know, having somebody, you know, having, you know, the refuges, Women's Aid, it's, and I'm not, so very strong at a grassroots level, and I'm not sure how that comes together nationally, you know, in a national sort of profile, really. What does the women's sector mean? What does it mean? You know, it's about, what's the epitome of that profile? And I think, well, so many places are closing, aren't they? I don't know what the figures are, but I would imagine a lot of women's organisers. I know that in the self-advocacy movement, like, I don't know, 60% of all groups have closed. So the priority is really about and that's just, I mean, they will be operating on a shoestring anyway. So it's just that final kick, isn't it, really, and taking everything away. So, and it's, well, it's the same for all, it's not just women, it's the same for all grassroots organisations. That's where it happens, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where it's most difficult to sustain it, I think. God, and I hate to think what's going to happen now.
Which brings us nicely on to achievements. In terms of WISH and the women's sector as a whole, how do you think it has influenced and changed women's structural position in the UK?
Well, we work with a very specific group of women. So, A, we have made a difference, a huge difference, life-changing differences to the women, a lot of the women we work with. Either, you know, to enable them to move into a different space or else to continue to support them. You know, women say, if it wasn't for you, I wouldn't be here. So there's that element, which I think is, you know, our most important contribution, if you like, at a service delivery level. Then hopefully now we've got back onto our into our campaigning routes, we're going to be able to make, you know, a difference at that structural level. But honestly, you know, you could be, you know, sometimes when you go and speak, you could be talking about women, and you could be standing on the table with no clothes on, you know, and they'd, you know, they'd still wouldn't be taking any notice of you, you know? It's like, it's almost like it's so entrenched in our psyche and in everybody's psyche that, you know, women are worth less, really, and therefore don't deserve the same attention. And I don't know, I mean, I think at a structural level, so it would be through campaigning. And of course, we put gender on the agenda. And, you know, back in the late 90s and early 2000s, it was WISH that did that. And I've got some details that I probably can't share with you, but we were ousted from our position, if you like, then. We were excluded from the debate by a woman who was power hungry. So there's that we lost our position there. And it's also, this is a bit meddly, but you know, it's about, you've got to retain your integrity. You can't do whatever you've got to do. You can't do things and not retain that integrity. So we've had, there's another organisation that's quite newly formed that we've had a few clashes with because we've been excluded from the debate, which doesn't really make sense, you know, given that we've got a wealth of knowledge and experience, and we were excluded from the Women's Mental Health Task Force and not given any information about what was happening there. So, you know, the women's sector, you know, isn't, you know, is on a spectrum, if you like, really. And I think we've really got to be careful that we don't get drawn into, you know, these places like, you know, can I mention any names? Not individual. Huh? Okay.
If you do mention.
So, what was I saying?
I think we were talking about women's structural positions and moving on. What do you think are the greatest achievements of women's collective action?
Well, obviously, completely raising the profile of the power imbalance, the societal power imbalance, I would say. And just keeping gender on the agenda, basically, not going away, not giving up. But I think very often, in order to, you know, keep in the at that position, there can be a temptation to be drawn into other people's agenda. So I think that women, it's important to feel part of that women's movement, and to stay true to it, really, and not to be drawn out in order to improve the position of the organisation. I think that once you start to get into that pecking order of women's organisations, then you lose, you know, the most important thing is that we are, you know, a collective and we are one voice.
What do you think still needs to be done?
Get rid of institutional sexism, I suppose. Simple as.
Big ask.
I know. But it's a process. Things have changed, haven't they? A lot. What still needs to be done? I think driving forward change. I think the balance between providing services, you know, the much needed services for women who are at the very sharp end of society's or societal pain, if you like, and the need to carry on campaigning for change, but also not to profile it as campaigning as such, because then that raises, you know, alarm bells, doesn't it? What's it trying to change, sort of thing? But just make it a reasonable ask, basically. And actually, you know, the research we've done about the role of male staff in prison, it's not going to be hard to change some of those things. Make it easy. Make structural change easy. Not a command from above. Make it, you know, facilitate it, and then show the benefit, because there's benefits, you know, to everyone, to women and to staff and to finance, you know, the financial implications as well. If you've got better services, you're getting better with money, you're getting better value for money, and you're supporting women to have better life chances and opportunities, which can be less of a draw on the person. It's a win-win situation, really. But I suppose, you know, that's from my perspective. It's not going to be from everyone's perspective.
What are your thoughts on the future for women's rights?
Well, I mean... about? The right to be equal, the right to feel equal, the right to have an equal say, the right to be treated equally, the right to, you know, the right to employment, the right to a fair wage, the right to respect for doing what you're doing, regardless of whether it's paid or not. I don't know. I think you've just got to speak up. I think there's different levels, isn't there, really? There's supporting women to speak up for their rights. There's actually speaking up for women's rights when you see an injustice, just doing it as a part of, you know, national part. It's difficult. I've never felt disadvantaged as a woman because I've always had a strong voice. And that makes it a bit difficult being part of this, really, because... but having said that, yeah, I've just never, ever seen it, and I've never been prepared to accept it either. So that is a bit weird. But I mean, look at... You know, some of our female politicians, we don't want to have to become like that, do we, to have power? But I suppose it's, you know, if we can't address the structural, then it's always going to be a fight. And I think in order to do that, you know, there's got to be common understanding that women can retain those qualities and characteristics, and it's different for everybody, and be in a position of power and not have to compromise on things and not accept harassment, or, you know, not have to, you know, be able to feel entitled to have and not feel they've got to give something in return that they don't want to give, basically. I think it's about, yeah. Well, I think it is about women stepping into their power, speaking their truth and feeling okay about it, and not being bothered about what people think about them, basically. Because, you know, look at some people. You know, look at what's happening in politics now. Male, you know, how can, you know... Unbelievable that people can be saying those sort of things. They don't give a, you know, they don't give a toss, do they, really? And it's absolutely, you know, unbelievable, incredible, unacceptable, you know, outright rise. But they don't care. I'm not saying that women should be like that. But, you know, they should, and I think because they don't feel confident, they often, it comes over as weak and apologetic. Whereas really, it's got to come across as strong, and, you know, this is what I think. And I think, obviously, I'm an older woman, but possibly not, haven't had the same, you know, I'm not affected as much by other women of my generation. But we've got a stronger group of women coming through, but just hopefully... They're not coming through on a mail ticket. I mean, I suppose that's my concern, really. But everybody's different, aren't they, really? And in the end, you know, man or woman, it's about integrity, equality, justice, compassion. I think, you know, and gender liquidity is now becoming more of a common term, isn't it? So it's about embracing that, really, for everybody.
Thank you. I've come to the end. If there's anything that you would like to add?
No, I don't think so.
Thank you very much.